We're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Total Celebrity segment, and I'm excited to welcome the program from Bravo's Project Runway, Carly Kloss, Kristen Siriano, and Elaine Welteroth. Guys, thanks for calling, and thanks for coming on the show.
We're great. Thanks for having us.
Great. First question to Carly. Tell me about the diverse contestants that are on Project Runway.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's part of the reason why this show is so inspiring. You know, I grew up in the Midwest and did not think I would have anything to do with fashion, felt like it was a whole other world. And watching Project Runway gives you a window into that world. And I think that, you know, there's so many amazing designers we have on this season who are all different ages, come from all different places around the world. And it just goes to show that creativity and ideas come from anyone and anywhere. And I think that this show really celebrates that.
Elaine, same question to you regarding diversity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an important part of the show, and it's an important part of the conversation that's happening in the fashion industry right now. And so I think that the show celebrates diversity and inclusion is something that was really important for all of us when we came on to the new Project Runway. And personally, I was really, really inspired by a woman on the show named Nancy, who is 64. She is the oldest Project Runway contestant we've had in history, and she is killing it. And she has one of the most just magnetic personalities, and she is so excited to be there. And I think that her presence on the show is just a reminder that it's never too late to chase your dream, because this is someone who, while new to fashion, she's only been designing for 3 years. You know, she was working in corporate America for 4 decades before she decided to take the leap and do something creative with her career, and she's thriving, and it's just incredibly inspiring to watch that.
Absolutely. You have that passion, you could be successful and never give up in your dream, regardless what people say. You never give up. You continue to focus and build that passion, learn that passion, and create. And even if you're in a dead-end job, just keep going. Don't listen to what people think. Do something and put yourself out there and take that chance. Take that risk. Christian, can you tell me about the amazing challenges that will be on Project Runway on Bravo this year?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot of great challenges this season that reflect kind of the times and what's happening. You know, I love the idea that we have sustainable challenges. We have challenges that celebrate, you know, different body types, all different types of people. We have challenges that, you know, there might be some people that maybe have a disability. I think that's really exciting to design for. So I think all the challenges really, again, like, it is this idea of celebrating people in fashion, and that you can be from all walks of life and love clothes and want to wear clothes. And I think, yeah, and I think the designers are really talented this season. I think they work really hard, and they strive for something great. And they also are very passionate group,
very passionate. Sassy.
Yes. They definitely really believe in something. And I would rather have somebody that believes in something that doesn't believe in anything. So I think that that's exciting to watch.
Yeah, there's a lot of passion that's poured into all the designs. And, you know, I, like Christian said, I think that it's part of why we're so excited about this show, is we really wanted to create challenges that reflect the real things that designers are designing for and thinking about.
Well, you guys are passionate, and that's the important thing. This group in general, you help motivate these people to be successful and put their true passion into what they do. And if you weren't passionate, they wouldn't be passionate.
Oh, but I think fashion is something that is universal. You know, I think it's subjective. Everyone has their own opinion of what is fashionable. Not everyone always agrees with us judges and our opinions.
We don't always agree with each other.
We certainly don't always agree. But, you know, I think that's part of the power of it, is that it is, you know, fashion can help transform how you feel in your own skin. That's part of what I really love about this industry and kind of the role that fashion can play in your life every day, getting dressed in the morning and putting something on that just makes you feel a little bit more confident when you're walking out the door. And, you know, and really that's what it comes down to. I think it's like, you know, this show is really celebrating the creative process and the talent of all these designers. But, you know, I think it speaks to so many people. I think the show really is such a, it really speaks to everyone.
Yeah.
Elaine, this season's going to be a little different than other seasons, and it stands out in certain ways. Why is that?
Well, personally, I have to tell you, it is my favorite season of Project Runway ever. I haven't seen, you know, the full edited season, so I'll be watching right along with America at the edge of my couch. But I just found this particular crop of designers to be really a cut above the rest. Like, I was blown away by their talent, and it really made our jobs that much harder, and I think that much more interesting as well. You know, we are all from the fashion industry, from different parts of the fashion industry. And as a, you know, former editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue, a big part of my job was to identify emerging talent, to help cultivate them, to help, you know, amplify their voice and give opportunity. And so I felt like, I just felt really invested, I think, in the growth of the designers this season. And and also they came in with a lot of confidence. You know, I think never seen a more confident group of Project Runway contestants. Some of them, I learned on the teaser for the first episode that they think that they're already on Christian and Brandon's level. Yeah. And I just thought, well,
they can have my bills.
but I think that was really interesting to just see how confident and how talented they really were coming into it. And then on top of it, I mean, I will say my favorite challenge was the Paralympic challenge. And I won't say too much about it, no spoilers, but it's really, really moving and something I have never seen on Project Runway before. And then there's the guest
judges. The
guest judges bring something special, I think, this season.
Agreed. I think there's a lot of really great guest judges that we have, you know, whether it's Cyndi Lauper, who's a personal fave.
An icon.
Yes.
Me too.
Yeah, and you know, Leslie Jones, another great judge, Laverne Cox. I mean, people who have their own perspective on kind of and experience in being dressed. You know, I think that's another relationship that a designer has to think about is the person they're dressing and how important it is to take their perspective into it too. So there's a lot in store for this season, that is for sure.
Carly, should I give up trying to be fashionable because I'm 6'10"? It's very difficult for me to find clothes, and I wanted to see if you guys can help me out and make me more fashionable. I'm a former professional wrestler, wrestled with The Rock before he was The Rock in the minor leagues of professional wrestling. Can you guys help me?
I'm wearing a couple inches of stilettos here. We're on the same level today. But listen, tall people problems. I feel you so hard on those.
Short people have problems too.
I get it. Listen, I think you know. How do you find pants? That's what I want to know.
I wish you could see me in person to see how I find pants. Hopefully we'll connect on the red carpet sometime and you guys can help me out. I appreciate you guys calling in Thursday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern on Bravo, Project Runway. Guys, tune in and thanks again for calling. And I really enjoyed learning a lot about what's going to happen this season. And thanks for coming on the Neil Haley Show, guys. Take care, guys. And thanks again. Bye-bye. You're listening to Neil Haley Show and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Neil Haley Show, and I'm excited to welcome the program the Managing Director of North America for Diamonds Producers Association, Christina Buckley-Kale. Christina, thanks for calling, and how are you today?
Me.
Really excited to be chatting with you today. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of this industry and the fact that only thing I really, really know about it is when I had to pick my engagement ring X amount of years ago and go through the process of understanding diamonds. And today's interview, with what I've seen, what you guys do, I'm so excited to learn more, because all I had to trust the expert while shopping for diamonds. I didn't understand exactly why, what was the difference. I just had to educate myself. And there's, I guess, a lot more available of experts like yourself than there were 20 plus years ago, right?
That's right.
It's something that you
and the story of
Go ahead, sorry, go ahead.
No. And the story of diamonds, you know, I think when people start the journey for, which is typically the first diamond investment piece is the engagement ring, is looking and exploring the four C's. But the story of diamonds and natural diamonds goes way beyond the four C's and hasn't really been told in new ways. So, you know, a Diamond Producers Association, we're here to really provide more insight and inspiration to instill trust and confidence in your diamond journey purchase.
All right. So talk to me about natural diamonds. What does the process look like?
So most people don't know that a natural diamond is probably the oldest thing you will ever own or wear. Natural diamonds are billion-year-old miracles of nature.
Oh, really?
And they have
Wow.
enduring inherent value because of their rarity and uniqueness. Yeah, it's pretty crazy when you think about the fact that the youngest natural diamond record is 100 million years old. And, you know, people don't really have an appreciation of the genesis of natural diamonds. And it's really quite remarkable. And because of their natural formation, you know, every single diamond is unique. So like each of us, every, you know, natural diamond that you choose for yourself or for your loved one is unique.
See, I, again, wouldn't have known that specifically enough when they talk about this, but are natural diamonds rare?
Yeah, there's, you know, some misconceptions around the rarity of natural diamonds, but indeed they're incredibly rare. Kimberlites, if you will allow me just get a bit sciencey
sure,
for a moment.
Perfect.
Kimberlites, the ancient underground volcanic pipes that hold most of today's diamonds, are incredibly hard to find. And in fact, most of the diamonds recovered today come from kimberlites that were discovered decades ago. And diamonds are becoming rarer every day because no new discoveries have been made in about, I would say, 20 to 30 years. And we just did a study recently, and we were able to actually measure that the total amount of 1-carat diamonds recovered annually and globally would fit just inside one exercise bowl. So that helps put things in perspective.
Oh, it definitely does. And you kind of can see those differences. So I'm increasingly reading more about industrial diamonds made at high temperatures in factories. What are the differences between manufactured diamonds and natural diamonds? And why should consumers care?
Yeah, excellent question, because there seems to be a lot of confusion out there. But industrial man-made diamonds, otherwise known as lab-grown diamonds, you know, while they claim to be the chemically the same as natural diamonds, there are big differences. And I guess the first is the origin. You know, they are made in factories, and they're trying to replicate a billion-year process over a period of 2 or so weeks. And that, as you can imagine, requires a tremendous amount of heat actually hotter than the surface of the sun. And imagine the water required to cool that. So, you know, these lab-grown diamonds, they position themselves as an eco-friendly alternative, but it's still unclear, you know, if indeed that's the case, because data shows otherwise, and the Federal Trade Commission is also calling out lab-grown diamonds to substantiate these claims. But I think what's really important during the season, when the peak season of diamond shopping, is to understand that, you know, that lab-grown diamonds and natural diamonds are different, and they can be detected with the right instrument, but their value proposition is very different. You know,
yes.
Lab-grown diamonds are about, I think, 40% less than natural diamonds, but that rate continues to decline. I mean, it's a tech product, right? And with, you know, economies of scale, you know, the value, the price will continue to drop. So, you know, is there a place for, you know, buying a lab-grown diamond? It's great for fast fashion, maybe costume jewelry, but for that milestone piece, you may want to think twice about that kind of investment.
It almost sounds like if you compare hardwood, the industrial hardwood versus the real hardwood, you know, it's part of it's hardwood, but the other part of it is not. And they try to compare them as though they're the same to sell to people. And it sounds like that's the same thing when it comes to diamonds.
Yeah, I haven't heard that analogy before, but that's a good parallel. But, you know, I think the difference is there consumers, at least for the most part, are clear about what they're getting. And, you know, right now, because it's sort of a tech and trendy, you know, value proposition, there's still a lot that needs to be clearly outlined in terms of what a lab-grown diamond is. So that's important for an elite, especially for the Diamond Producers Association, is to just provide that education and information so that the consumer can be empowered to make the best choice for them.
Because when you, here's the thing that kind of goes in the story of just looking for an engagement ring. You could go to one place and the price for that diamond would be 10 times more than another. So that's why you have to educate yourself with someone like Christina and look at this organization, because ultimately at the end of the day, you could buy a diamond, like almost like a car, for 15 times as much if you didn't educate yourself, and then go and find out the value is half of what you paid for. And then there you go. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I got totally messed over. And there's really, sometimes I think if we're just talking about diamond engagement rings, there really is no way of kind of stopping this stuff from happening unless you educate yourself.
Well, yes. And also, you know, just always ensure that you're working with, you're going into a trusted, you know, retailer, and they should have all the, everything clearly identified. They should have all the proper paperwork and you know, certification. And if they don't, then yes, you should be leery. But, you know, the work with a trusted jeweler.
And that's the problem. And that's why you have to go and check these things out. Here's a great thing that I never heard this quote, but it's very interesting. The Diamond Producers Association often says, diamonds do good in the world. What does that mean?
Yeah, there's really important global impact that the diamond sector has. I think there's a lot of misconceptions and stereotypes that, you know, haven't been addressed. And, you know, the diamond industry, I think most people aren't aware, it is incredibly regulated, right? And in order for even diamond mining to happen, it can only do so on a foundation of sustainability. And that means, you know, working in symbiosis with governments, local communities, environmental officials, et cetera. And I don't think people realize the scale of impact. You know, globally, diamonds come from Canada, Australia, Siberia, South Africa, and beyond. And, you know, the DPA, you know, the major diamond producers, when they first came together in 2015, you know, they, as, you know, individual companies, realized how much progress and positive impact that they've had, you know, in the communities, in the environments within which they work, but they haven't come together in this way to actually measure how are we doing? How are we tracking? So a couple of years ago, they engaged with a third party auditor to measure exactly that. And the results were really insightful and illuminating. You know, one thing you can absolutely feel confident about is that, you know, in purchasing a natural diamond, that the majority of what you invest in goes directly back into the local communities from which the diamonds originate. You know, $16 billion a year in benefits, and 80% of that goes back into the local communities. And when you think about the employment and education and healthcare, you're talking about positively impacting the livelihood of 10 million people worldwide. And also, it addresses some of the misconceptions around the environmental footprint. Absolutely, there is improvement that needs to be made, but it does put some things in perspective. You know, globally, diamond mining operations equate to the size of 325 square miles. That's the size of New York City. And they protect more than three times that amount of land. And, you know, when it comes to CO2 emissions, they're working with hydropower and wind power to reduce the carbon footprint. But, you know, if you put it all in perspective, you know, the carbon footprint of a 1-carat diamond equates to the carbon footprint of a single passenger flying from New York to LA one way. And think about how often you fly, and think about how you hold onto your diamond jewelry for the long haul. And there's a lot of innovation happening in this sector, and we're looking to have our first carbon neutral mine in 5 years, because kimberlite ore, which I mentioned earlier, from which diamonds are extracted, actually stores carbon dioxide in a non-toxic manner, and that can have implications for other industries as well. So there's a lot happening, and to learn more about that, you can visit total-clarity.com, where you can see all the insights and the data, and more importantly, the human case studies and anecdotes.
Any tips or tricks for us that can help us, especially when we're shopping for diamonds? I brought up engagement, but now this is the holiday season. Diamonds are the perfect gift for anyone in this time of year. So any tips and tricks for us so that when we're shopping, we make the right choice?
Yeah, I guess a couple things there. I mean, like I said at the beginning, go beyond the four C's. You know, you may, of course, there's a lot of value with the diamonds that sort of hits the marks on all the four C's, but inclusions make the diamonds that much more unique and beautiful. And you just, you know, think about the diamond, look at the diamond in a way that speaks to you. Like, yes. I said, every diamond is unique. And you also might have a design style that's maybe not as trendy, but it speaks to your personal style. So don't restrict yourself in your options. And yeah, you know, it's very interesting. The diamond customer of today has definitely changed. It's not, you know, just, you know, men buying engagement rings. Women represent more than 30% of the value of diamond jewelry sales in the U.S., and that's only continuing to grow. Women are buying for themselves. They're not waiting for, you know, she's not waiting for her partner to buy her the diamond jewelry gift. So, you know, think about really crystallizing those milestone moments. I mean, there's nothing more that can do that than the symbol and beauty of a natural diamond.
And this puts a good theme in fashion, especially, hold on a second. Yeah, this really is a great theme when it comes to fashion, especially. Then you think about diamonds and fashion. So when you talk about now people are buying for themselves diamonds, not just for someone else, that really changes the game. But I think it has to do with fashion, right? A diamond is a perfect accessory for going out. It's a perfect accessory for specific types of events or things that people go to, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not just the sentimental value or symbolism of the natural diamond, but it's also an expression of your personal style. And it's so great that, you know, we can be even, you know, more unconventional in how we wear our diamond jewelry, and wearing, you know, diamond jewelry during the day through tonight. And it's not just something that's limited to special occasions or to your engagement ring or to the red carpet, for that matter. Although the red carpet season that's coming up is always an exciting one to see the diamonds, you know, sparkle in their utmost.
Speaking of red carpets, I got to attend a red carpet for the new Mr. Rogers movie in Pittsburgh, and that's an interesting thing. I need to get to the ones in L.A. That's what I really need to, because I'd enjoy those, covering those. I've gotten one in near L.A. in Anaheim for an event. But again, that's the perfect time. You're right. You need that jewelry accessory, and self-gifting yourself is a great thing, and it makes you feel good when you're wearing certain diamonds, just like a certain dress or certain other types of accessory. Having a diamond on you can be based on your mood and stuff, right? And this is what I want to wear today and to feel great about myself.
Yeah, and you know, it's so personal. It serves as something, yes, I can express style and beauty, but I can also look at it and it holds so many memories. And whether it's a memory that's shared with a loved one or just a memory of something that I've accomplished for myself that, you know, is best embodied in a natural diamond and for all that it represents.
All right. Best place we can find information on you and learn more about you, Christina. Where can we go to learn more about this so that people can make the right choice when it comes to diamonds?
Great question. You can visit realisadiamond.com. You'll also see a short film on Real as a Diamond that depicts the diamond journey, the billion-year story of the diamond journey, and it's as a symbol of love over time and space. And it's a really beautiful film, and I think everyone would enjoy it, and it may have them think about diamonds and perceive diamonds a little differently as well.
I appreciate you calling and really teaching us about that diamond process. You're listening to Neil Haley's show, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and we're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Total Celebrity segment. I'm excited to welcome to the program Ego Wodim and Heidi Gardner of Saturday Night Live on NBC. 45 years, Ego. Can you believe it? 45 years it's been on there.
I cannot believe it. That is older than I am. Yeah, that's crazy.
It is crazy. And Heidi, what memories do you have of Saturday Night Live growing up?
Oh my gosh, I still remember seeing like the opening title card for Wayne's World, or also actually just hoping I would see it, and then knowing like, oh my God, this is Wayne's World, and then it was party time.
That's my favorite, exactly, because yeah. If you can have a dream to create something yourself in your basement, you never know where you can go. It always reminds me of when I started, for sure, because of an independent artist that I am and syndicating on 150-plus stations and starting my own internet radio station. I started just like Wayne's World. Maybe I'll end up that big someday. Who knows? Ego, your favorite memory on Saturday Night Live. Favorite number. What is your favorite memory on Saturday Night Live?
Oh, man. I'm so close to that, just being in my second season. I think that's so far my favorite memory is being in the studio right before live and looking up and seeing the audience and being like, whoa, this is really happening. So far that's stuck with me and is such a special moment for me. But then there's a myriad of moments since then with host and my cast members that I could count as well. But like that first episode is really special.
And Heidi, I'm going to jump back to you. What about your favorite moment? But I guess I couldn't imagine going on live, Heidi. I mean, so just being on there, your memories of Saturday Night Live, and then just to go live and say, hey, we're live. Anything can happen.
Yeah, it's a pretty insane feeling. It kept me grounded to just remember that there's a studio audience and that I'm also performing for them. So I just kind of thought, oh, actually, I'm just performing for these 300 people in front of me. There's not like millions behind that camera. So I kind of just try to play a mind game with myself to not be nervous.
So Ego, what should we expect for this season coming up?
I mean, we have some really great hosts in store. We have J-Lo coming this week, Scarlett Johansson, Eddie Murphy ending out the year. I think just the next 3 weeks are going to be incredible. And if they're indicative of what the rest of the season holds, I think we got some really good stuff in store as well. But I think we're going to be hopefully doing a lot more sketches together, Heidi and I, as well as Melissa and Chris and the newcomers. And that's something I'm really looking forward to also.
Me too.
And that for sure. And out of the different guest stars you've worked with, Heidi, who have you enjoyed the most? Or is it just like if you had children, you'd say these are my favorite? It's hard to say who your favorite guest star you've worked with so far.
It is really hard to say, but my first season, Charles Barkley hosted, and that's someone I've always looked up to my whole life. And he was hilarious and a lot of fun to be around. And then anytime an alumni comes back, so Tina Fey, Seth Meyers, Adam Sandler, Will Ferrell, that's always a gift.
Ego, how about yourself? Who have you enjoyed working with the most?
Gosh, I mean, truly all of my castmates, but as far as a host goes, I feel Adam Sandler was incredible. Had so much insight and watching him work was so fun. Maya Rudolph, watching her has been wonderful, but Will Ferrell came back. That was great to watch, and that was just our last show. And then seeing, like, for instance, someone like Harry Styles, who just proved himself to be a jack of all trades, it's been
they're also great. So I do sort of feel like that parent is like, oh, my kids are good.
Hey, they are. And it's always exciting. You never know what's going to happen next, Heidi. And again, when you rehearse for it, it's got to be a challenge, right? Especially because you never know if that guest host is going to decide to do something different, right? Or even your castmates do something different. So when you're kind of rehearsing and then finally you go on, you never know what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, that's fun. And that's really the best thing about performing. You know, you could have done it one way 100 times. And once you're doing it for the actual live show and that adrenaline's up and you're feeling the chemistry with the host and your cast, like, you know, all bets are off. And that's what's so exciting. And that's what I think makes it exciting for the audience, too, is you can genuinely see us having a good time, a scared time, but it's a time. So.
And that's what's exciting. And Saturday Night Live, again, everyone knows when Saturday Night Live is on. Look forward to the next guests coming up. And I appreciate you guys coming by. And best of luck and continued success. If you're going to be as successful as the rest of the cast of Saturday Night Live, I'm going to see you in some big, big things coming up. So I'll be looking forward to checking out your careers and seeing them continue to grow. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Neil Haley's show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, Neil Haley. And it's always very interesting, Author's Corner, especially working with Triumph Books. As a huge sports fan, looking at rivalries, we look at Ohio State, Michigan, how finally the Big Ten is back. Or some people just say Ohio State's back. Then we hear about the hiring of Jim Harbaugh. Does that mean that Michigan football is back? Well, I have an author on the program today. It's going to talk about the days of when Michigan was fantastic. So I'm excited to welcome to the program Dr. Frank Lieberman, author of Bo's Warriors, Bo Schembechler, and the Transformation of Michigan Football. And Dr. Frank, do you think we're going to have a transformation of Michigan football again with the hire of Jim Harbaugh?
What's wrong with the second transformation? Who said transformation is singular and only can happen once in a lifetime?
I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping Pitt football that we have a transformation soon from the days.
Well, what's different this time is that Bo Schembechler took over the recruiting classes from Bump Elliott. And he had a lot of talent. Bump recruited good players. So unfortunately Brady Hoke maybe didn't have the same quality of players, but I think Jim Harbaugh is going to make going to definitely do a transformation.
Well, I think so too. Look at how he made Stanford who Stanford was when really.
Well, Stanford, yeah. Also the 49ers.
Yeah.
And just look what he did, for example, with Vernon Davis. I don't know if you're familiar with the Niners, but the Niners had Vernon Davis, and Vernon Davis was just not performing up to his potential and was in the doghouse all the time. Harbaugh comes in. And now Vernon Davis is all pro.
Right. And that's what Harbaugh is able to do for sure. And you're right. The 49ers were down in the dumps. Stanford was down in the dumps. So he's going to easily come in here, especially to Michigan, and win quickly. And the way it works is basically he has to deal with the players that he was given. But ultimately, Michigan has talent. Yet they just haven't been able to perform on the field in the last 5 to 7 years. So I think this is, again, something where it's time for that change. And Big Ten football, I think, is definitely back. But when you talked about Bo Schembechler, and especially what your book about this transformation, you said that they already had good talent that Bo inherited. But what led this complete transformation? Was Michigan winning under the coach before Bo Schembechler?
Well, good example. So in 1968, the last game of the season, Michigan was 7-2. The record 7-2. Back then, they played a 10-game season. Ohio State was the national champion, undefeated. And so Michigan plays Ohio State at Ohio State at Columbus. So Michigan's 7-2. Ohio State is 9-0 going into that game. So at halftime, the score is 21-14, Ohio State.
Right.
All right. Michigan's in the game. Final score, Ohio State 50, Michigan 14. And it was 48-14. Now for the extra point. Woody goes for two, not one, for two, to make it 50. So, of course, he's asked, why'd you go for two? Woody says, because I couldn't go for three.
And that proves the rivalry, that he wanted to destroy Michigan.
He wanted to destroy Michigan. So in the freshmen the freshmen of 1968 are watching the game on TV. Of course, they're not traveling with the squad. And there's a group of men, black athletes called the Mellow Men. There's seven of them. And they're watching this, Reggie McKenzie and Tom Darden and Billy Taylor and so forth. They say, we're not going to allow this to happen, to be the embarrassment. We're not going to allow this to happen. So these freshmen then became sophomores in 1969. And so the difference right away was, back then, Bump Elliott didn't have a real great conditioning program during the off season. So then with Bo coming in, Bo was brutal with his off season conditioning in the winter. He had these players running around, working out with these different kamikaze-like drills. One drill, for example, is called slap and stomp, where basically he puts two players in a ring, and they start slapping each other and stomping on each other in close quarters. Well, at the time, the defensive end, Cecil Pryor, got teed off, and he knocked this player out of the ring.
Oh.
His teammate.
Oh, my gosh.
But Bo Schembechler jumps into the ring, looking at his defensive end, and says, you want to fight somebody? Fight me.
Wow.
Reggie McKenzie is watching this. Do you know who Reggie McKenzie's history? And okay. He's saying, oh, my God. This guy is something else. That got his attention right away. So that's what Bo did is he made these players think differently about competition and got them to believe in the unbelievable. He changed the mindset because one of the players, Frank Gusick, he was called Superman in the press. Frank Gusick is saying to himself, if I'm doing all this physical exercise and all these crazy drills, just think of what's going to happen in the fourth quarter. I'm going to be still in great condition, and I'm going to be able to beat up on these other people because no one else is doing this stuff. That's an example of how the thinking changes.
Right. The toughness. He wanted to get toughness out of his players. They were talented, yet they did not know how to go to war. And that's the big component that Michigan needed to be as tough as Ohio State was under Woody Hayes and then later after that.
Boak called them country clubbers. He said, you guys are country clubbers. That's your reputation. He changed that. Working man's mentality. He changed that without a doubt. He got their attention.
Now, what made Bo Schembechler this kind of guy? You know, he comes in as a new coach at Michigan. Michigan has been winning, but not winning to the point what the university wanted and they wanted the program to be. And he comes in with this tough attitude. How did the players, you know, how you said he jumped in at one point in time, but how did those players respect him to go out and go to war for him? What kind of qualities did Bo have?
Well, okay, number one, super competitive. Tough. He treated these players brutally in practice. He swore at them. And I have the language is very colorful. Reggie McKenzie, for one, didn't spare anything in terms of the language that Bo used, the way he talked to his players. So I'll give you a good example of that. There was this one player who was a running back, and Bo was short of running backs during that practice. So he had this running back run plays for the first team, which is about 60, 65 plays. And then he had the same player run the plays for the second team, another 60, 65 plays. So this player's run maybe, you know, involved in 130 plays during this practice. So at the end of practice, he has everybody running wind sprints. Do you think he allowed this player to take a break?
No.
No.
No, he didn't.
And this player said, I'm not going to let him beat me, to his teammates. Bo is not going to beat me. And that's what they did. In other words, they didn't want him to be able to take what he did. So a lot. And then another example is that during a recruiting class, Billy Taylor and Tom Darden were actually in high school phenoms. So Bo was coaching at Miami of Ohio, and he was recruiting these players. So they come in for, you know, meet the coach and expecting steak dinners and all kinds of treatment. Bo says, get in your workout clothes and your running shoes. He put them through drills. Now, wow. Billy Taylor and Tom Darden, Billy was from Barberton, Ohio, Darden from Sandusky, Ohio, and they didn't know each other prior. So, but they met back into the locker room after the workout, and they looked at each other, said, this guy's crazy. We're not going here. As it turned out, both went to Michigan. So Bo's now at Michigan in the end of 1968-69. So he's meeting with his players. So Darden walks in the door. You know what Bo says from the first words? You thought you got rid of me, didn't you? Close the door. All right. So not only that. So Bo is brutal on the field.
Yeah.
And then off the field, he meets with these players individually and finds out about who they are. Jim Betts' father was an alcoholic. Bo is married to an alcoholic. And they start talking about alcoholism and what it's like to be with an alcoholic. So in other words, he begins to relate to them on a personal and on their level.
And they eventually
begin to learn, he really cares for me.
So he's one of that. Yeah, right. And so
on that field?
Yeah.
No, on that field, he played no favorites. He treated everybody like dogs. That's what he said. I'm going to treat you all the same, like dogs. And he did.
And see, that's interesting, and that's another part of tough love. There are fathers out there, especially father figures, that are tough guys that really didn't take any guff from their kids and really pushed them to that point. That's the same thing, but then they knew that there was a true love, that he loved them. So off the field, he cared for them, really wanted to see them succeed, but on the field, you better do this or else. That authority.
Well,
yeah, right. Not else.
Not only that. Mm-hmm. The other thing, Neil, is that after they had these reunions when all the players and coaches would get together, banquets and so forth, Bo talked to every one of his players. They didn't have to be a superstar. Every single one of them he knew and he connected with. Everybody. The practice squad players. He knew everyone's name, and he was involved with everybody. That's unusual.
No, definitely that seems very unusual. And I think that when you look at look at Ohio State and specifically how Woody Hayes was, later on the Ohio State program, you had to have that real mentality of hard work. And Michigan, that's how they grew. So from the caring point, he must have been a great X and O's guy as well, because you can't just have just them tough players go out there and play. He knew the game, didn't he?
Well, he knew the game, and of course, he learned it from Woody. He played for Woody Hayes at Miami of Ohio.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Woody Hayes was also a Miami of Ohio coach. Miami of Ohio put out Webb Eubank, Bill Mallory, Eric Persegian, just a number of these outstanding coaches were involved with Miami of Ohio. Sid Luckman.
Wow. So definitely that Miami Ohio tree. So that kind of, I'm sure, got Ohio State pretty upset to know that Bo Schembechler was mentor was Woody Hayes, and now he's
so
going
he
to
then he went and coached for Woody at Ohio State.
Never knew that story. So that's got to be that's got to be a weird story. Let's say the top assistant at Penn State went on to coach at Pitt during the heyday. And then that'd be craziness. The people in Ohio State must have hated him beyond belief to see him compete against Ohio State.
Well, not only that, you know who he took with him? He took one of Woody's co-captains, Gary Moeller.
Oh, my.
Gary Moeller was a co-captain on Woody's undefeated All-American number one ranked team. He took Gary with him to coach.
Wow. So
Gary became his position coach. Let me tell you another, I'm just going to make a transition here, just give you a little coincidence. Jim Harbaugh actually was born in Toledo, Ohio. Do you know who else was born in Toledo, Ohio?
Who else?
Urban Meyer.
Oh, my.
They're like 7 months apart in age.
Wow. Oh, is this getting interesting?
How about a coincidence that?
This is definitely getting so interesting in so many ways. I mean,
not only that, Neil, is that Bo recruited lots of Ohio players. He said, Woody's not going to get them all, and we're going to go out and work on getting as many as we can. Bo's staff was from Ohio.
And you know, Western PA and Ohio were the best football players were at that time, for sure.
Without a doubt, yeah.
And so he knew how to recruit that area, and that
he knew how to recruit, and he had his players recruiting. For example, when he recruited Jim Betts is from played at Benedictine in Cleveland, Ohio. He brought with him, Bo brought Jim Mandich. Said, okay, Jim Mandich. Jim is thinking, okay, well, I'm going to be throwing to Jim Mandich. Jim wound up as being a second string quarterback, but first string defensive back, and wound up being drafted by the Jets. But so he involved his players, and these players today have no qualm about recruiting, going out and helping their coach. No qualm about that.
So how long did it take for Bo to really start winning at Michigan? How many years?
Okay, well, let me tell you some statistics that's going to blow your mind. So Bo comes in 1969. The team is 3-2. They lost to ranked Missouri. Missouri just kicked their ass. And then they lost to Michigan State. So they're 3-2. They're playing Minnesota in the little brown jug. Michigan's behind at halftime. Bo comes in and says, don't let this opportunity get away from you guys. I'm paraphrasing. You're better. So Michigan winds up dominating the second half, blowing them out. Okay, so now they're 3-3. Then now they're going into the last game of the season against Ohio State, undefeated in 22 straight games, number one ranked team in the country. Jack Tatum, you probably know that name.
Yes.
He's one of Woody's boys.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Woody has all these All-Americans. And so they're 17-point favorites to win in Ann Arbor. Okay? So Michigan upsets them. That becomes the start of the 10-year war. So that season, Michigan is 8-2, right? They were 3-2, but they won the next five games, so they became 8-2. Next season, they're 9-1, so they go from 8-2. Next season, these are 10 games in the season. 9-1 the second year. The third year, 10-0. So they won after that 3-2 start. They were 24-1.
Wow.
Dominated. So talk about the transformation of football. The Wolverines, these players that I interviewed, these were the guys that did it. They tell their stories and how and what Bo was like. This is about them and their perception of Bo, and they hated him at first, they love him today.
And Bo, that's what you said, they hated him at first, and now they love him today.
I'll give you another example. Reggie McKenzie, at the end of his senior year, Bo and Bear Bryant are coaching an all-star game and college all-star game in Lubbock, Texas. And Bo says to Reggie, Reggie, I'd like you to come and play in that all-star game. Reggie says to me, I'm through with this son of a gun. I don't want to be around him anymore. I'm done with him. So, sorry, coach, I have another commitment. So Reggie says, no, I'm playing in this all-star game. So 2 years later, Reggie's now with the Bills. He comes back. He's going to start a foundation. He goes to Bo. Bo, I'd like to start a foundation. I need some equipment. Bo gives him footballs and shoulder pads and all kinds of stuff from Michigan. And Reggie says, I love that man with all my heart.
Wow. Some players some really well-known names that our listeners would know, that we know Reggie McKenzie for sure, but other well-known names that played for Michigan under Bo Schembechler.
Well, how about Dan Dierdorf?
Yeah.
Does that name ring
a
bell?
Yes, definitely rings a bell.
Okay. Tom Curtis has two Super Bowl rings.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Moeller, Jim Brandstetter, he's the voice of the Lions and the Wolverines. Tom Darden was the All-American. He holds the record single season and career interceptions with the Cleveland Browns. He's one of their top 50 players of all time. Mike Keller. Mike Keller played with the Dallas Cowboys and then puts together different leagues, and right now he's putting together a spring football league. Jim Betts, I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Moeller, who coached Fritz Seifert, Frank Gusick. These are the guys in the book. And so it's their story, their experience with Bo. And now, here's another statistic. Of the guys that I interviewed, Gusick, is from Cleveland. Darden is from Sandusky. Moeller is from Ohio. Curtis is from Ohio. Betts is from Ohio. Dan Dierdorf from Ohio. In other words, most of the players turned out to be from Ohio.
My gosh, wow. Yeah.
And they're Michigan. And now, they're not Ohio. They're not. None of these guys live in Ohio. They live in Michigan.
It's definitely an amazing story, to say the least, what Bo Schembechler was able to do. And you're hoping that same thing will happen with Jim Harbaugh. And I have a feeling it's going to be an interesting run between Ohio State and Michigan for years to come, for sure. And Dr. Frank, what made you interested in writing this book? What are you just a huge Michigan fan your whole life? What gives you the reason to write this book?
Well, I have a master's from Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so I remember I was studying for my qualifying exam, or no, it was prelims, actually, in 1969. And so with a study group, and we're watching the Michigan game. So that got my attention. That got my attention. But I go back and remember my early experiences, memories of football go back to Michigan, Ohio State, very young age. So as it turned out, I'm living in California, and I hook up with Mike Keller, one of the players. And I said, Mike, I'm interested in, you know, mental toughness. I'm doing some research on mental toughness. I want to interview some players. So we start talking, you know, Gil Brandt. I talked to Gil Brandt. I talked to Jack Youngblood. And then I start hearing more about Mike and his career. And I'm thinking, geez, this 1969 team, I'm beginning to learn more and more about the history myself through Mike. So I decide to switch gears and say, okay, I'm going to interview Michigan guys, guys that Mike played with. And then he referred me to Brandstetter, and from there, everybody else. But basically, with mental toughness is the theme, and I devote a lot of information on that in Mike Keller's chapter, because Mike also was involved in player personnel, evaluating players and putting together leagues and so forth. So I presented my definition and my idea of mental toughness and got his ideas, and we basically talk about that in the book.
All right. Well,
what it is and how to define it and why it's so important.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Frank, where's the best place we can find information on you? I know we can purchase the book at Amazon, but also at triumphbooks.com and all those different places. But is there places to find you as well?
Yeah, you could go on Bo's Warriors would be one website, and or else you could go, here's another website, genius.com, Frank Lieberman, Bo's Warriors, and it'll number of posts about Bo and Jim Harbaugh. But yeah, I think Bo's Warriors blogspot.com, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well,
yeah, Bo's Warriors blogspot.com, and that'll give you a number of posts, and plus the genius.com. That's another one.
And then triumphbooks.com, you can just buy the book right there, or Amazon or any bookstore.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Yeah, you can buy it there.
Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you, Dr. Frank, and learning about Michigan and learning about Bo Schembechler, because I didn't want to bring up that the same week I had Earl Bruce on the program. I definitely will put him on. I'm not going to. But Earl was tremendous, and his he had a different coaching style, especially how he mentored some of the great coaches after that. And it's interesting, and he was under Woody as well. So it's interesting to see the development of these coaching trees under Woody Hayes, and how some develop certain coaching styles and others develop other coaching styles. And that's what's so fascinating about